You're listening to In the Vault, a KPMG banking industry podcast series.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Liz Lamadou, a principal in KPMG's banking and capital markets tax practice. And joining me today are two colleagues, John Tomaszewski and John Montgomery. They're both from KPMG's compensation and benefits tax practice. So John Tomaszewski is a managing director who focuses on the taxation of benefit plans, and John Montgomery is a partner focusing on employment taxes. And John Montgomery, I'm going to call you Monty for ease of today's discussion since we have two Johns, and since that's what I'm used to calling you, I think that'll go a little better. So welcome, everyone. Today, we want to talk about fringe benefits. So we're going to talk about what they are, how we commonly see them in a banking organization, including some tax planning opportunities and pitfalls to be aware of. So John, let me start with you. And why don't we just start at basics? What's a fringe benefit and what are the tax consequences of fringe benefits?
Thanks, Liz. Happy to be here. Yeah, fringe benefit is basically any form of compensation other than salary and bonus. So some common examples include, healthcare coverage, personal use of an employer-provided airplane, gift cards, meals, employer-provided vehicles, things of that nature that are other than salary and bonus. And under the Internal Revenue Code, the general rule is that any fringe benefit's going to be taxable unless the Internal Revenue Code excludes it. So for employees, what this means is that that income constitutes wages subject to applicable income and tax withholdings, reporting on a W-2. And then the last thing just to be mindful of is that even if the fringe benefit isn't provided to the employee, so for example, if it's provided to the employee's spouse or a child, that would still be taxable to the employee.
Got it. And I think now that you say that, certainly we've all received some sort of fringe benefits, I think, and so understand that concept. What is usually the driving force for employers to provide the benefits? Monty, can you take us through that?
Sure. And I think there's several driving forces, some that are been historical and continue, and some that are new kind of post-pandemic. One of the driving forces of fringe benefits has always been to provide benefits to employees to differentiate themselves from competition. The second is certainly both historically and now is to help differentiate an employer to attract new talent and retain existing talent. Certainly in the current labor market, there's been a high focus on trying to retain employees as well as attain new ones. I think in kind of the post-pandemic world, one way we're seeing that is certain fringe benefits and incentives for employees to come into the office as we're in this return to office model, whether that's 5 days a week or some type of hybrid model of potentially 1, 2, or 3 days a week, and trying to get employees to come in, whether that's through meals, reimbursement of transportation costs, parties, whatever it may be. That's really, in our new way of working, one of the biggest drivers currently is just trying to get employees to actually come in.
That makes sense. And I think we were all seeing a lot of that, right? There are definitely lots of meals being offered at the office as an incentive to be there. So I also think that in this employment market, I don't know, I've seen banks take a hard look at how their employees might value different fringe benefits and trying to determine what they actually place the value on and maybe reshape what the banks are offering. But John, let's talk for a second. Can you help us understand how employers value the fringe benefits on their side?
As you brought up, it's not going to be valued on the employee's subjective valuation of what the fringe benefit is worth. For these purposes, the fringe benefit's valued at fair market value. And what fair market value means is really what would that price be, or what is that value in an arm's length transaction? So any type of subjective perception or even what the employer's cost is not what the value is. The value is what would be the value in an arm's length transaction. That said, there are special valuation rules for certain fringe benefits. For example, employer-provided vehicles, employer-provided aircraft. The IRS regulations provide for special valuations, which generally is more favorable to employees, and it's not necessarily what the fair market value is. And just, you know, lastly on this topic, just to keep in mind is, you know, valuation is what's going to flow into the income to the employee, but then you're able to back out from that income recognition any amounts that the employee actually pays for the fringe benefits. So if there's a reimbursement or any other type of payment by the employee, that would reduce the ultimate taxable income to the employee.
So what I'm hearing is fringe benefits are taxable unless the law provides otherwise. And it's important that it gives a fair market value to what that fringe benefit is for purposes of taxation. But what are some of the typical exclusions from taxable income?
Sure. And the Internal Revenue Code has numerous provisions that provide that certain fringe benefits can be non-taxable, taxable only up to a certain point, or even taxable only after a certain point. So there are various ones. When we think about the various buckets, and these are things that people probably run into every day at their own employer. You know, one great example is benefits that are provided through an employer health and welfare plan. So when we think about healthcare, dental, vision, there are other buckets around qualified employee discounts, working condition fringe benefits, de minimis fringe benefits, which are basically benefits that are provided that are so infrequent and such a low dollar value that it would be extremely difficult for any employer to track and actually include an income. So the IRS does give us a de minimis fringe benefit amount. You know, some other examples are education assistance programs where you can have an exception up to a certain dollar threshold for qualified educational assistance. You know, we sometimes will see that where employers will provide employees, you know, reimbursements to get an additional degree. And I think lastly, and one that's very pertinent in our new kind of return to office world, are the employer providing meals on site and whether those meals, there's an exception if it's for the employer's convenience, not if it's for the employee's convenience. That can be a very difficult distinction, but a very important one as to whether or not it's going to be taxable. And I think because we're seeing fringe benefits being used as a push to get people to come into the office, we're seeing the meals quite a bit. And that's a one to certainly focus on.
Agree. We're definitely seeing that more. If you guys don't mind, I'd love to talk through a couple specific fringe benefits. So let's take meals. What are the tax issues we should be thinking about for this as a fringe benefit if the employer is providing meals to the employees? And what are you seeing around this, Monty?
Sure. Certain types of meals might fall under a taxable exclusion and others might not. And I think there's even been a change on this really since 2020 as to whether a meal should be considered a compensation. So, you know, one exclusion for meals is if it's provided at the convenience of the employer, which means that it's for the employer's need, provided on the premises. And it's really because the employee has to be on site to do their job. We see this sometimes with hospital employees. You know, certainly industry to industry and even company to company, that definition could be different depending on what your employees are doing and really defining what is a true need to be on site. There was a period of time during 20 and 2021 where meals were being provided because people had to be on site and nothing was open because we were all in a lockdown state. And so you didn't really have the ability to get food even if you wanted to. But now post that point in time, meals are still being provided on site. And really we've got to hone in on whether or not that's for the employer's convenience or not. You can also see examples for meals provided to employees whose break time or ability to get food is so short that they really don't have the time to be able to go offsite and get something. The other large item we look at that we're running into quite a bit is, you know, the meal can be excludable from an employee's income if it's considered a de minimis fringe benefit, which, as I stated earlier, is that it's such a small value and so infrequent that the accounting for it would be unreasonable. Even the IRS agreed it would be unreasonable, and thus we're going to let it go. So when I think of that and under the kind of umbrella of meals, we think of kind of like the snack room. Like if you want to go and you grab a bag of chips or a protein bar, a bag of candy, whatever it may be, that's very de minimis. And there's no way any employer would be able to track kind of who took what snack, as opposed to kind of a full meal if I'm bringing in lunch and I'm bringing it in every day so that we're doing it on a regular basis. It's no longer really de minimis because there's an actual larger value there and it's no longer infrequent. That's something we're seeing quite often where the meals are being provided quite regularly, sometimes every day, where you would kind of lose this exceptional or de minimis fringe benefit. We've historically seen a lot of IRS audit activity when they are auditing an employer, whether it be for corporate tax or employment taxes, that one of the buckets they do hone in on are fringe benefits that are provided to employees. And meals has been a big one for a number of years. And there's been news activity on it. There's been IRS reviews on some larger companies that provide kind of three meals a day and 24-hour food, and whether or not that really becomes a taxable event. So the audit activity around meals is only going to continue to go on for the next few years. And I think we'll start to see more honed focus on it as it relates to meals provided both during pandemic and post-pandemic.
That makes sense. And as usual, you have enlightened me because what I thought might be simple was actually quite nuanced. So let's cover one more fringe benefit. How about commuting costs? I have heard some additional information or new information about this in the last couple of years. So, John, can you talk us through the tax issues to think about for commuting costs?
Yeah. So with respect to commuting costs, similar to the other fringe benefits, there's a couple of nuances that we need to be mindful here of. And commuting costs really fall into two buckets, if you think about it. You have what's called qualified transportation fringe benefits. These are items, for example, you buy your train pass, or you park at the train station, you buy a bus pass, things of that nature. A lot of employers have qualified transportation fringe benefit programs where you're allowed to, you know, defer some of your salary into, you know, your commuter plan. And then that pre-tax money is then used to buy your bus pass, train ticket, things like that. So that's one aspect of this. But then as Monty mentioned earlier, you're having employers also, as an incentive to get employees back into the office, providing additional commuting benefits outside of the qualified fringe benefit programs. So for example, hey, you know, I'll give you $100 a month, you know, you could go buy your train ticket, or, you know, you could pay for your gas in your car if you're driving to the office, things like that. Anything that's going to be outside of the qualified fringe benefit programs is going to be taxable. And also we have to be mindful of the rules with respect to deduction disallowance as well with commuting expenses. So, you know, again, a lot of nuances here, a lot of different issues, but just have to be very mindful of, you know, the qualified fringe benefit program rules and then other personal commuting expenses, which are going to be taxable income to the employee.
Thanks, John. Given all these nuances, let's talk briefly about potential consequences for not properly applying the rules for fringe benefits. So, Monty, what happens if an employer isn't doing this right?
Sure. So like any wage inclusion item, failure to properly report taxable fringe benefits as wages, it leads to an underreporting of wages, but it also means that we've not properly subject all taxable wages to income, federal and state and local income tax withholding, as well as Social Security and Medicare taxes. Anytime an employer underreports wages and thus has an under withholding on payroll taxes under IRS regulation and state regulations, when an employer fails to report and withhold on the amount that should have been treated as compensation, the IRS and even the states are able to collect the under withholding from the employer rather than the employee, since it was the employer's obligation to properly treat and withhold the amounts upfront. So in addition to the tax principal, you can also be assessed penalties and interest for the failure to properly withhold and deposit employment taxes. And so the principal amount as well as the penalties and interest can lead to a larger exposure for employers. In addition, as John mentioned, certain expenses such as commuting expenses are not deductible. So reimbursing an employee for commuting expenses results in income to the employee and no deduction to the employer. We see that also around entertainment expenses where the deduction can be limited. So some fringe benefits, including including the entertainment expenses and employer-provided aircraft. There can be special valuations for the income exclusion, as well as limited deductions.
So that sounds like you're kind of the worst of all the worlds. It seems like if the employee is going to be taxed on it, you'd like to see the employer get the deduction for it. So being taxed and not getting a deduction is like a double whammy.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree.
So if I boil this down to a couple key takeaways, we think it's important that banks periodically review the fringe benefits that they're offering to their employees to determine whether those are being properly taxed to the employee and properly deducted by the corporation. And I think this could come into play both to the extent that there is benefits being offered to the employee that are not being included in income, which should be, which can lead to issues for both the employee and the employer. But I presume that could also go the other way. And maybe there are things being taxed to the employee that actually could qualify for an exception and are not subject to being treated as wages. Is that right, John?
Yes, that's right. Thank you.
It's important to get it right for the taxability on the employee side, but then also equally as nuanced is whether or not those costs at the corporation level are deductible for the bank. And certainly we want to make sure we're not in a situation where something is taxable on one end and not deductible on the other. So thank you, John and Mani. This was a great discussion, and I certainly learned about a lot of complexities on this issue. I appreciate you guys taking us through this. Definitely some interesting things to think about, and I look forward to having you guys back, and we can talk about a couple more fringe benefits. For our audience, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. This is Liz Lamadue on behalf of KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. I look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks for listening to In the Vault with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.